This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is Robert Duvall. He's known for memorable performances in The Great Santini, The Godfather 1 and 2, Apocalypse Now, Lonesome Dove, The Apostle, which he wrote and directed, and for his Oscar-winning role in Tender Mercies, written by his longtime friend, playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote. At age 79, Duvall is hardly slowing down. He recently appeared in the films Crazy Heart and The Road, and he stars in the new film Get Low, where he plays a reclusive old man with a long beard who lives outside a small southern town in the 1930s. In this clip from the film, Duvall's character, Felix Bush, has come to town to plan his own funeral. He's meeting with the undertaker, played by Bill Murray, and his assistant, played by Lucas Black, and he has an unusual request.
And I want to be there.
You will be, I guarantee
it. I want to be there now.
You want to be at your funeral party alive?
Yes, sir.
But you can't have a funeral if you're not, you know, deceased.
Hold on now. It's a detail. We can look at it.
Pretty big detail.
I spoke to Robert Duvall earlier this week. Robert Duvall, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, sir.
I wonder if part of the appeal of this film is that every neighborhood has some mean old man or woman that the kids are afraid of and everybody wonders what their story is.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even where I live in Virginia, you go to each small town, there's even what you could stretch it a bit and call it the village idiot. But there always is the strange guy in the town or whatever surrounding the town. And this gentleman is certainly one of them, although it's by choice. And he's not illiterate. You know, he could have been many things. He could have been a doctor, a lawyer. But he chose this hermetic style of life, you know, on purpose. It's a legitimate choice on his part.
Right. And part of the film is us learning that he, as everybody, has their own story.
Absolutely.
And it's gradually revealed. I thought we should listen to a bit of the character here. You've already decided that you're going to have this – your funeral party while you're still alive. That is to say, your character Felix Bush is, and he's here.
Right.
One of the things he's done is gone on the radio, and to ensure that he gets a good crowd, he's selling raffle tickets, and for $5 someone can enter the raffle, and the winner gets Mr. Bush's property. That is to say, your character's
right.
property. So plenty of money's coming in, and in this scene, you're there as Felix Bush, and you're talking to the undertaker, who's played by Bill Murray, and his assistant, who's played by Lucas Black, and you're talking about some of the financial arrangements.
Right.
Can I trust you?
Every name, every dollar is on this table.
Not what I asked.
I've done a hell of a job for you. I don't see why.
Mr. Bush, I didn't mean to imply
that. I've sold horses, cars. I mean, I've sold watches or been the inside of my coat. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't rob banks, don't cheat at cards. I sleep all right. Nights I sleep.
Take out for the expenses you already had and give me the receipts. When the bills come in for things you give them to me, I'll pay them. You put this money in a box, the boy and I'll take it someplace in the morning. Whatever new comes in, listen to me, whatever new comes in, you keep in the bottom one of them ugly caskets in there till I come get it. When the party's over, you name a fair price for what you've done, and we'll settle up. A fair price.
And that's our guest, Robert Duvall, with Bill Murray and Lucas Black in his new film, Get Low. You want to tell us a little bit about developing this character and the voice?
And the voice, the inner voice, the outer voice, whatever. The script was so wonderful, and I lost interest for a while because the script was wandering, and they brought Charlie Mitchell in from Alabama to put the final touches, and then they finally raised the money. But I just let myself follow the logic of the script in developing the character, and if there was any outside voice, I didn't want to – didn't really go for an accent. I just want kind of a flavor from my father's people, from the farming people from Virginia.
Right. And this is a man who presumably would probably spend days, weeks talking to no one but his mule who he lives with.
Exactly. And the United States champion mule comes from, you'd think, from Tennessee, Texas, Georgia. It came 20 miles from my home in Virginia in Front Royal. Stevie Foster's mule down there, Gracie, they sent down because mules by nature don't rear. They're very smart. They don't rear. But we needed a mule that could rear when the guy throws a stone at the mule. So This mule can pray, go to the mailbox, bring you a letter, play the piano, do many things. This mule is trained to do that. But the mule was his only companion, really, through these years, and except for an occasional trip into town, and self-styled exile, you know, I guess, you know, which he really felt he had to do to become this hermit, so to speak.
This film was shot in a little town in Georgia. I'm wondering,
yes,
would it have been different if you'd been on a soundstage somewhere?
Perhaps To Kill a Mockingbird was totally done on a soundstage because in those days they didn't really go out to location. I think being on location does add something of a dimension, definitely, that reality. I think so, yeah. For instance, the extras we got, they would come at 4 in the morning and stay till 8 or 9 at night. You know, it's the first time they were in a movie. Like in Hollywood, they have their trades magazines and they come in and that's it. Being so used to that, there's a certain jaded quality that sets in. These people were very fresh. It only lasted 2 to 3 days, so they didn't get a chance to get jaded or bored. They were wonderful, wonderful to work with and added a wonderful voice collectively themselves to the movie. It was wonderful to have that.
You know, you mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird. That was one of your early film roles in 1962.
That was my first one. Yeah. My first one, the Horton Foote that made the adaptation from the novel.
Horton Foote, your good friend and playwright, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because when I give that final speech, the first time I did it, I only did it a few times. As the hearse comes on with the mule, my coffin that I'm for when I really, really die in the whatever near future, I'm giving that speech and my wife, Luciana, is off camera and she hears her phone ring and quietly answers it. And it's someone telling her that Horton Foote had just died as I gave that speech. She got goose pimples, and after the scene was over, I was very kind of moved. It was like full circle from To Kill a Mockingbird till that point, you know, like he was there almost. It really was, yeah, it was something. Because I had told Horton I was doing this movie and I wanted him to see it because it reminded me a lot of his work, you know. Like it's really kind of like a Horton Foote movie. But he never got to see it, but he seemed to be there at that moment when I was doing that final speech.
You know, I read a fair amount about you, and people talk about your ability to completely disappear into a character. I forget which director said, it's almost eerie that Robert Duvall becomes that character. And then I've also read you say, no, it's work. I mean, you prepare and you bring some of yourself to it. You never leave yourself. You don't transform. And,
never.
And at that moment—
If you do, you're in trouble.
Okay.
Yeah, you do. It's like play acting. Kids play house, right? You play the preacher. I'll play the kid. You play the kid next door. And the kids play house. And here we play house as grown-ups. We get paid good money to play house. So it's a game, really. It's a game of, it's a game. You become the character, but it's really you turning yourself in a certain way. As if you become the character, but you cannot lose sight of who and what you are. You have one set of emotions, one psyche, one soul, and you don't become another thing. It's you. It's all those things turned to what seems to be something different.
You did so many memorable supporting roles earlier in your career in the 70s. In fact, I read in a piece in the New York Times that one problem you had was that audiences didn't always recognize you from one movie to the next because you disappeared so effectively into those roles.
Right.
One of them, of course, was the consigliere Tom Hagen in the Godfather roles.
Right.
Did you realize that these were going to be such iconic films as you were making them?
Absolutely. I mean, a third of the way through, I said— Godfather 1, I said, this is going to be pretty important. And I can remember when the film was finished and we had an opening night party. I think it was at the St. Regis Hotel. And there was a wonderful buzz and a wonderful feeling around the whole film of Godfather 1. And I remember, I won't mention names, a well-known film director came up and said, you boys did a wonderful job in this movie. I want to congratulate you. He said, I don't know about the movie, he said, but... This guy never made a movie that good ever. I won't mention names.
Okay. All right.
So anyway, but there was always that feeling that, wow. And then Godfather 2, it went in. Well, Godfather 2, we didn't have Jimmy Caan on the set, so it wasn't as much fun.
Well, then, there was Apocalypse Now.
Right.
And
with Coppola again.
Right, right. And your portrayal of Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore is
right.
So memorable. I thought we should play this this one scene. It may be
initially the character was called Colonel Carnage.
No kidding.
But they had to water it down a little bit. That was a little bit too much.
A little too obvious.
Yeah.
Well, let's just listen to these famous words at a battle scene. This is you playing Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore in Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours. When it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking big body. Smell! You know, that gasoline smell! The whole hill. Smelled like victory.
And that's our guest, Robert Duvall from Apocalypse Now. Just tell us a little bit about you getting into the head of somebody who would love that gasoline smell and bodies burned so badly you couldn't find them.
Yeah, well, you just have to just go and do it. I was in the Army as a draftee, and I used to didn't know I'd ever play a guy like that. But I mean, out of curiosity, I used to just watch some of the special service officers and the way they behaved, the way they stood. And when I got over there, they had the character as Carnage, and they changed it to Kilgore, and they had him in a cowboy hat and boots. And some of the Marines and so forth, the more hardcore military, said, "Well, this didn't go on." Well, it did go on because I understood that the head general of the air cavalry used to deer hunt on his own along the Cambodia border on Friday nights, and his helicopter was shot down and he was killed. These guys did crazy things.
He was deer hunting from the helicopter?
Yeah, from the helicopter. And I was told that by a gentleman who had served, with the air cavalry. I mean, I guess guys, you have to have hobbies to break up the monotony. So, people have hobbies, I suppose, even in wartime,
Your character's hobby here was surfing.
Yes.
Was that in the script? Yeah. Did you come up with
it? Yeah, that was all those things were in the script. Yeah, very much so.
Well, I want to talk about Tender Mercies, the 1983 film for which you won the Oscar for Best Actor.
Yes, sir.
In this one, you were a Max Sledge, right? A once popular country singer whose career had dissolved in alcoholism, finds himself in a little Texas highway motel where the widow who runs it kind of takes care of him, and he puts his life back together.
Yes.
And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. And this is late in the film where you have, as Max Sledge, have heard that your daughter has died in a car accident, a daughter you had just reconciled with after many years apart. And in the scene, you're hoeing in the vegetable garden, and your wife, who's played by Tess Harper, comes up and asks if you're okay. And here is how you respond.
I was almost killed once in a car accident. I was drunk, and I ran on the side of the road, and I turned over four times. And they took me out of that car for dead, but I lived. And I prayed last night to know why I lived and she died, but I got no answer to my prayers. I still don't know why she died and I lived. I don't know the answer to nothing, not a blessed thing. I don't know why I wandered out to this part of Texas drunk and you took me in and pitted me and helped me to straighten out and marry me. Why? Why did that happen? Is there a reason that happened? And Sonny's daddy died in the war. My daughter killed in an automobile accident. Why? See, I don't trust happiness. I never did. I never will.
And that's our guest, Robert Duvall, from the 1983 film Tender Mercies. You know, as I hear that again, it's such a powerful moment. And this man feeling such pain, it's so intense, never raises his voice. You want to talk a little bit about him and this character?
Yeah well, this scene in particular, I remember that. I said, look, I would rather not loop this. Let's get the sound right. Because you're outside, so they put trucks around to and we didn't have to loop it, but and we did it.
When you say loop it, you mean like provide an ambient kind of sound?
No, will you add your voice to your voice to make it clearer at the end in post production?
Oh, I see.
You dub it, so to speak, and I didn't want to do that, and they hung back with the camera and didn't come in on close-ups because sometimes close-ups it spells it out too literally, and they left the camera rolling and it kind of worked for me in a nice way, you know. So. It's just a guy, you know, down and out, but he had a support system in this woman that he married, in the stepson, plus a baptism, and he was able to weather his bad habits he put behind him, and it was a wonderful part to play. Once again, Horton Foote, Horton's so great at drawing these specific kind of characters in a wonderful way, you know, and. It's just as a guy that, he found his niche with this wonderful woman that he married. He got baptized and on the road to a better life, really, from the kind of disdainful and broken down life he'd led before. But then after he's on his way to recovery, he finds the daughter that he reconciled with was killed, which is pretty devastating to him.
You know, this is one of several memorable characters that you created that are Texans. And when I read your biography, I just expected you to be a native Texan. Do you have enough?
My mother's people are from New Boston, Texas. But I like Texas a lot. My wife loves it. She's from Argentina. Maybe it reminds her of. Although she does say Virginia is the last station before heaven for her. We live in Virginia. She loves Virginia. But Texas, too. And I know some of those border sheriffs and some of the Texas Rangers are good people. And it's nice working there in Texas.
You know, I read that when you were shooting this, you and the director, Bruce Beresford, had words a few times. Did you guys have differences about how this character should be?
Well, just different opinions. I've worked twice with a couple of times with Australian directors. They have maybe I do too. They have attitudes. They're so far away from us. We got it done. We got it done. You know, Bruce Beresford, talented guy, and we got it done and so forth. I'd rather have, conflicts with people and have the end result be worthwhile than have it totally harmonious throughout and then the final result is not that good.
Right.
Like Beresford said one day in rehearsal, would you please pick up the pace? And Wilford Brimley said, well, I don't know anybody dropped it, So there was a difference, but we got it done. We got it done, Bruce did a very good job, yeah.
Uh-huh. You do sing in this film, and
yes, sir.
I gotta say, sing beautifully too. Is this a career you might have had?
No, I don't know about it. Both my brothers were professional singers, but they sang opera. And I sold my apartment in New York. I shouldn't have sold it. I sold it in like 6 minutes. It used to belong to Caruso, and I used to play Lefty Frizzell records while everybody was from the Metropolitan would be warming up, and they sent messages to me, "Would you please turn off that country music?" But I've always liked country music, and. I did what I had to do. I like to do my own. I dance the two-step, and I like to do my own dancing, my own horsemanship, and my own singing in a movie. And they tried to block that in the contract that maybe they could loop somebody else. And my brother, who was my lawyer at the time, would have no part of it. I was to do my own singing. That was it. That's why I took the part. Really, I didn't want somebody, and they would have had legally the right to. Dub somebody else's voice in if we hadn't blocked it contractually.
Were they happy with the result in the end?
I think so. I think they were. Yeah, I think they were. Yeah. But it's funny, we went to publicize the movie and Willie Nelson liked the movie a lot, and I got to know Waylon Jennings from that because they liked the movie a lot. Willie Nelson said he would help with the publicity, and the head of publicity in New York City of Universal Pictures said, well, we don't need Willie Nelson. How could he help publicize a movie like this? I mean, is that crazy? I mean, come on. And then Willie said, well, now, did you ape Merle? I said, no, I didn't ape Merle, but I like Merle Haggard a lot, but, I didn't really. And then George Jones thought it was his life story, and everybody thought, tried to cash in on it. But it was something I just kind of brought things together and made it my own.
It was your own creation. It was Max Sledge. Let's hear a scene from Tender Mercies, where Duvall's character, the former country singer Max Sledge, is sitting with his guitar in the kitchen, teaching a song and talking to the son of the woman he's married. He's played by Alan Hubbard. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
What happened to your money?
I lost it.
How?
Too much Applejack.
You think you'll ever be rich again?
Well, I'll tell you what, Sonny, I don't lay awake nights worrying about it. No. Now, look, there's a D, right? D is in dog. Now, watch me. I'll call him out. I've decided to leave G here forever. Not really. Let me know if you're staying behind. That's A7. Otherwise, I'll be gone in the morning. D is in dog. Let me know if you're staying behind. Now you can play a covered chord or a rhythm chord. Let me know. That's G. If you always will want me, or if you'll wander into another.
One of Duvall's most memorable roles was that of Augustus McCrae in the 1989 TV miniseries Lonesome Dove. At the heart of the story is his relationship with Tommy Lee Jones' character, Captain Woodrow Call. Both are former Texas Rangers. Duvall's character loves life and talks about his feelings. Jones generally doesn't. In this scene from Lonesome Dove, Jones has come upon Duvall, who's weeping over a lost love, and their conversation turns to prostitutes, and one that Captain Call has apparently fathered a son with.
I don't know why you sit down on whores, Woodrow. You've had yours, as I recall.
Yeah, and that was the worst mistake I ever made.
It ain't a mistake to have been a human being once in your life, Woodrow. Poor little old Maggie left you a fine son before she quit this world.
You don't know that. That boy could be yours or Jake's or some damn gambler.
Yeah, but he ain't. He's yours. Now, anybody with a good eye can see it. Besides, Maggie told me. We were good friends.
I don't know about friends. I'm sure you was a good customer, though.
Well, the two can't overlap, you know.
You're the one that didn't know about overlapping with whores, I reckon.
You know what hurt her most? You wouldn't call her by name. You never would say Maggie. That's what hurt her most.
I don't know what it amounted to if I had.
It would have made her happy.
What are you talking about? She's a whore.
Well, whores got hearts, Woodrow, and Maggie's was the most tender I ever saw.
Well, why didn't you marry her then?
She didn't love me. She loved you. You should have seen how she sat in that saloon every day watching the door after you quit coming around.
I reckon the man has got more to do than to sit in a saloon with a whore.
Like what? Go down the river every night and clean his gun? Maggie needed you. You let her down. You know it too, don't you?
No, I don't know anything of the dang kind.
And that's why you won't claim that boy as your own, because he's a reminder, see? A living reminder that you failed somebody. And you ain't never going to be up to admitting that. Now are you?
Like I said, Maggie was just a whore.
Well, I got Woodrow. At least you finally called her by name. I guess that shows some improvement now, don't it?
And that's my guest, Robert Duvall, with Tommy Lee Jones in the series Lonesome Dove. You know, you guys are both, you mount and ride horses as you're having that conversation. You were both horsemen, right?
Yes, sir. Back then I rode everything back then. Jumping horses, English saddle, Western saddle, yeah, especially to get ready for the part, yeah.
Did you know Tommy Lee Jones? Had you worked with him before?
No, I met Tommy Lee when we were going to do that. I went to his ranch down there in San Saba. We talked. We herded cattle in Argentine polo saddles. We went out, and I got to know him. I haven't seen him too much since because he lives way down there, and it was a good experience working with him and Ricky Schroeder and all the women. It was a wonderful experience, wonderful. My ex-wife, who lives there in Philadelphia, Gail, she was the one that told me to read this book. She liked it better than Dostoevsky, a great, great novel, and that to make sure that they gave me the part of Augustus, not the other part, which they were going to give me the other part. But we talked and arranged it so that I could play Augustus, you know. So if she's listening to the show, I want to thank her for that.
And Augustus fits you better. Why?
I don't know. It's just, you know, because I've played those more covered guys before, but, you know, this was more of a muted guy. But with he's a more outgoing guy, Augustus, and suited a certain side of my personality, may as much or more than the other part, really. James Garner was, they offered him the part. I said to my agent, he handled us both, if you can get him to switch parts, I'll be in this, and I don't want to play the other part. So he called back a few hours later and said, well, James Garner can't be on a horse for 16 weeks. I said, well, okay, now go after that part. And he did, and so he got me that part. So I really, really, I really loved it. I really did. My favorite, probably.
Yeah. This is a film about a cattle drive, and
yes.
I don't know if you use stuntmen at all. I mean, I guess you and Tommy Lee did not, right?
Well, only the only time they used a stuntman when I had to ride down among the buffalo, which was a little hairy. But I did most all my own riding, and my horse got a little iffy, so they put me on a ranch horse, a local ranch horse, which were good and more sound, so to speak, and well broke. But then that was working great until the pistols went off, and then this horse started bucking, and I stayed on for about 4 or 5 seconds, and then I bailed, or he helped me bail, and the cowboys were laughing. Oh, give me a 75 on that ride. They were all laughing, and I said to the director, you know, get a cutaway me on the ground, getting back on. So they were able to use it when the horse actually bucked, and I came off, so they really used it. But, you know, I did all my own riding. I took the horse to the ground when I had to slit his throat and use him as a shield. And the stuntman, Rudy Uglin, showed me how to do that. So I was glad that I could do my own riding. You know, it's because it was, that's because they were only horses. There were no cars way back.
Yeah, you know, that really was one of many moments that I remember from that series. You're being chased by a bunch of guys,
right.
About 7 or 8 guys. You're not going to outrun them. And so you quickly dismount, cut your horse's throat, drop him so that he forms a shield,
yes.
And you fight these guys. It's amazing.
Yeah, and Rudy and those guys showed me how to drop him because he was a falling horse by training.
And you know, the other great scene is the death scene where you've been shot by an arrow and get gangrene, and you and the Tommy Lee Jones character have your farewells. I mean, it is a tremendous moment.
Yeah.
What's the legacy of that series in Texas, do you think?
Well, it's like a Bible to them down there. I mean, these people, they just – other parts of the country and world is too, but in Texas, wherever you go, it's just people watch it 30, 35 – once a year they get together with the families and watch it. It's really like a – I don't know what the word is. It's just a special thing for the people of Texas. It really, really is. I even understand a gaucho out in the country of Argentina wore out a copy of Lonesome Dove, although it was looped, got dubbed, because down there they say, hey, como que tal Gus? Call me Gus, Goose. Oh. Hey, Goose, que pasó?
Que tal meaning what's going on, right, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
They dubbed it, but... But, you know, in Canada, too, all the way down, the American Western is ours. I say let the English have Shakespeare, the French Molière, the Russians, Chekhov, and South America, they have Borges in Argentina. But the Western is ours, really.
You wrote and directed the film The Apostle. In 1997,
yes, sir.
A story
and financed.
Oh, that right,
right.
The thing that gets forgotten, but that's so hard to pull off.
Oh boy,
this is the story of a Pentecostal preacher that you play, a flawed man who faces a crisis in his life when his wife finds another man and he is ousted from the church that he's the preacher. Let's just get a bit of you in this film preaching.
I'm preaching like I'm going to war this morning. I'm a genuine Holy Ghost, Jesus-filled preaching machine here this morning. I tell you, I'm a genuine Holy Ghost, Jesus-filled preaching machine here this morning. Now, if God be for us, who can be against us? He's God here in this radio station. He's God in Georgia. He's God in Tennessee. He's God in the pulpit. He's God at the front door. He's God in the 7-Eleven. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. And why do I say this? Oh, why? Because I got Holy Ghost power here today. We're going to have a Holy Ghost explosion. We're going to short circuit the devil here today. And the Holy Ghost is our power line to heaven. I'm going to tell you right now, in days of old, Moses went up into the mountain. When he got up in the mountain, high on a mountain, the Lord God above gave him 10 commandments. He didn't give him 11 or 12 or 13 or 14. He gave him 10 commandments. And the 11th commandment, thou shalt not shout, does not exist.
Where do I sign up? That is our guest.
That's true. If you don't shout, you can't get to heaven, some of those people.
Our guest, Robert Duvall, from the film he wrote, directed, and starred in, The Apostle. Tell us where this came from. What was your experience with Pentecostal Christians?
I was doing an off-Broadway play called The Days and Nights of B.B. Fenstermaker, a wonderful play by William Hartwell Snyder that just was terrific. And I played a guy from Hughes, Arkansas, so I was flying back from California to New York, and I got off the plane in Memphis. I said, let me go to Hughes just to see what it's like. Not that you have to do that to be an actor, but I decided. So I went back, and there was no place to stay. The highway guys building a highway from Louisiana let me bunk in with them. I walked down the street at night. The sheriff gave me dirty looks. It was strange. But there was a little white clapboard church I went into, and I'd never been to something like that. There was a woman preaching a Pentecostal preacher, and I said, I've never seen anything like this, even in my own country. I want to put this on film someday. So it took me many, many, many years to get it off the ground, and finally I did. You know, when my wife came up, I finally got the go-ahead to do it, and I did resume my research that I did all over America, and she said, hey, Bobby, you think we'll ever go to any white churches? Because I love the black preachers. They're like surrogate fathers for their community, and it was a great, great experience. Right.
Right. And, of course, this isn't just about Pentecostal culture. It's about a truly fascinating character, I mean, your guy.
Yes. I pieced it together from many, many, many stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a tribute to the film that I watched this again over the weekend, and I still can't tell whether I like this guy or not.
I like him okay, because let me put it this way. What he did by killing a guy just out of the moment is not half as bad, one iota as bad as King David, who wrote the Psalms, who sent a man off to die by design so he could be with that guy's wife. That's what David did. But my guy just did it. So my guy wasn't as bad as some people, you know. So anyway, you know, he is what he is, really, you know. I mean, these guys, a lot of them start out, and some of them end up charlatans on TV. But I think even if he had his moves and his whatever, at the core of his being, he really believed in what he believed in, I think. So it was a labor of love, but, you know, something. I mean, I heard Billy Graham liked it, and I got a wonderful letter from Marlon Brando. He liked it, respected it, so I got it from the secular and the religious.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how evangelicals reacted to it. Yeah, they liked it?
Well, some didn't like it, I think, but you know, I mean, I talked with Pat Robertson. He just thought it was right on the money. It just was terrific, you know. And I mean, most people, you know, I get letters from people. My father was a Pentecostal preacher. My uncle was, and you got it exactly right. So I feel, you know, right. And there's always somebody, you know, like right. Some people didn't like The Godfather. Come on, you know. Great, great movie. So
I know your time is short, but you said you have some exciting roles coming up. You want to tell us anything about what's next?
Well, I do and I don't, because of these times. It's so difficult to raise money. I can name four projects that are as good as any I've ever done that have come my way now. They're just absolutely tremendous part. The Hatfields and the McCoy, written by Eric Roth. It's like American Shakespeare. Unbelievable. Another script, A Night in Old Mexico, that this young French director, one of the top, is obsessed with doing, that Bill Whitliff wrote. He wrote the adaptation of Lonesome Dove. Then I'm supposed to work with Terry Gilliam, where I play Don Quixote. And then last week I received a script from Billy Bob Thornton and his writing partner that might put Tennessee Williams in the back seat, that Billy will direct himself. But so those four projects are terrific, as good as anything. You know, so before they wipe the drool, I got a few things I'd like to do. But, you know, I hope at least one or two of them come to fruition.
You ain't retiring, are you?
Well, like Michael Caine says, you don't retire. The business retires you. Hmm. So we'll see. I got a few years left.
Well, Robert Duvall, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for a wonderful interview, a wonderful job. Thank you.
Robert Duvall stars in the new film, Get Low. It opens next week in New York and Los Angeles and in the rest of the country in August. Tom Jones has been a pop star since 1965, when his first hit, It's Not Unusual, was released. Since that time, he's remained a star overseas, resurfacing periodically on the American pop charts. Jones has just released a new album called Praise and Blame that finds him covering gospel, blues, and R&B songs. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
What good am I if I'm like all the rest, if I just turn away when I see how you'll dress, if I shut myself off so I can't hear you cry, what good am I?
That's the opening song on Tom Jones' new album, Praise and Blame, a cover of Bob Dylan's What Good Am I? From the spare musical accompaniment that showcases a still strong and subtle vocal instrument, it's pretty clear that the 70-year-old Jones is good for crooning with a pleasingly rough edge. In this country, Jones has always been a figure of some ambivalence. He became a star here for pop hits such as It's Not Unusual and What's New Pussycat. But when we first got a load of him on TV, he was a Welshman's variation on Elvis Presley, all swivel hips, tight pants, and growled menace. And in America, being an Elvis variation always means taking a sucker's bet. You can't win. Sure enough, Jones settled into middle age as a middle American star, mostly on TV variety shows and in Las Vegas. He's made occasional stabs at retro relevance, such as his surprisingly witty cover of the Prince song Kiss some years ago. Praise and Blame takes a familiar strategy for aging pop stars. Hook up with a hit producer, in this case, Ethan Johns, who's produced albums for everyone from Kings of Leon to Rufus Wainwright, and try to go the sincerity route.
I'm going down to the church house. Get down on my bended knee. Deacon Jones, pray for me. Deacon Jones, please pray for me. Maybe there ain't no hell. Maybe there ain't no hell. Maybe there ain't no heaven. No burning hell. No!
That's the first single from Praise and Blame. It's a cover of the John Lee Hooker song, Burning Hell. Now, it's possible the idea behind singing this song may spring from a dubious motive. Roughly stated, the authenticity of Hooker's blues gives Jones a splash of authenticity by association. But that doesn't mean it also doesn't sound really good. Even as a knockoff of the American performers who originally inspired him, Jones has always had his moments.
Oh, we heard church people say, they are in the holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On the last red judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day. Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
On the other side of the pond, Praise and Blame got a publicity boost when an email from Jones's British record label vice president was leaked, expressing surprise at Jones's song choices. Actually, the quote was, "I have just listened to the album in its entirety and want to know if this is some sick joke," followed by four question marks. Offended, Jones received an apology. The thing is, you know what this guy David Sharp means. His company lured Jones away from his longtime label, expecting to get hits out of him. This is something Jones did as recently as last year, when his version of the Bee Gees' Islands in the Stream went to number one in England. But the first record he turns in under his new contract is a bunch of blues and gospel covers? How disoriented this man Sharp felt. How wily Tom Jones is.
Oh, well, it didn't lift. Rain, children. Rain on my Lord. It didn't lift.
Oh, This odd, fun, faux hipster roots move on the part of Tom Jones is unlikely to be a big success here. It's too far over the horizon of the American pop landscape. But that's almost irrelevant to the musician Tom Jones is at the moment. He's managed to make himself something highly unusual for a man at this stage of his career. Unclassifiable, unpredictable. He's the Lady Gaga of Elvis impersonators, at once of the moment and eternal, disposable and persistently present. And to address that record executive's four question marks, Tom Jones is no joke.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Tom Jones' new album, Praise and Blame. Watching television between June and August, according to our TV critic David Bean Cooley, used to be a real chore and a real bore. These days, he says, it's anything but, if you know where and when to look.
For the most part, the story of broadcast television has gone like this. Just as bears hibernate in the winter, over-the-air TV networks hibernate in the summer. From the end of May, when the official TV season is over, until mid-September, when it begins again. Oh, every 10 years or so, the broadcast networks will wake up and try something new and interesting. Survivor and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire a decade ago, Northern Exposure a decade before that. But most of the time, what CBS and the other broadcast networks give us isn't much. This summer isn't any different. Oh, we have a fabulous summer run of Friday Night Lights on NBC. But to those of us who saw these episodes already when they premiered on satellite television's DirecTV, they're just another type of summer rerun. And some broadcast shows, like Glee on Fox, are worth watching more than once, so that's something, I guess. But where's the new stuff? Broadcast TV offers us plenty of first-run shows this summer, more than in the past few years, but they're mostly reality show or competition show junk, like Downfall and Big Brother, or subpar dramas like The Gates and The Bridge. The bright spots are few, if you don't have cable or satellite TV, but they are there. Fox has given us Bradley Whitford and Colin Hanks in the enjoyable cop comedy The Good Guys on Mondays. ABC has given us a thoughtful, engrossing documentary series in Boston Med on Thursdays. And that's about it. Ah, but on cable TV, summer is the season when quality TV really ripens. I hate to toss out a long list, but it's the quantity as well as the quality of summertime cable shows that counts. Instead of taking the summer off, my TiVo is working harder than ever, trying to keep up with shows I watch and enjoy each and every week. On HBO, just as Tremé ended, True Blood came back on Sundays, gorier, sexier, and funnier than ever. Showtime ended its seasons of Nurse Jackie and Secret Diary of a Call Girl, but hasn't taken the rest of the summer off. Its talk show featuring comedians talking comedy, The Green Room with Paul Provenza, was a delightful surprise. And in August, Weeds returns, paired with a new show starring Laura Linney, The Big C. On Tuesdays, FX followed its new cop show, Justified, with the newest season of Rescue Me, which is terrific. And with an ambitious new comedy from Louis C.K. called Louie, which I really like. The Sci-Fi Channel has a bunch of fun shows that either returned or premiered this month. Warehouse 13 on Tuesdays, Eureka and Haven on Fridays. And BBC America has been active, too. For genre fans, it has the newest episodes of Doctor Who on Saturdays, followed by a new season of Being Human, which is an alternately goofy and dark series about a werewolf, a vampire, and a ghost, all trying to just get along. BBC America also has what may be the sleeper hit of the summer, In the Choir, which airs Wednesdays. It's a documentary series about a young man in England building choirs from scratch and preparing them for international competition. And I absolutely adore it. That's a long list, but hardly a complete one. I haven't mentioned USA Network's Burn Notice, which is back on Thursdays, or the same network's new Covert Affairs, which just started on Tuesdays. Or TNT's Leverage, which airs Sundays, or Futurama, which Comedy Central just resurrected on Thursdays. And intentionally, I've saved the best for last, because a show is returning that could save the summer all by itself. On Sunday, July 25th, AMC's Mad Men returns for its fourth season. Last season ended with Don Draper, played by John Hamm, quitting his job, gathering some colleagues, and planning to start a new renegade ad agency. That's where this new season begins. And all I'll say about this opening hour of Matthew Weiner's fascinating drama series is that the dominant themes from the very first moments are about identity and reinvention. In fact, here are the very first moments, as Don is interviewed by a reporter from Advertising Age.
Who is Don Draper? Excuse me? Who is Don Draper?
What do men say when you ask that?
Well, they usually take a minute to think about it, and then they do something cute. One creative director said he was a lion tamer.
I don't want to do that. In a third person?
I don't know. Knockout wife, two kids, house in Westchester, pick the train. Maybe take your car, now that you can afford it.
Who told you that?
Anything? I mean, now's your chance.
Well, as I said before, I'm from the Midwest. You were taught that it's not polite to talk about yourself.
This is the Don Draper we've come to know and love. Enigmatic, soft-spoken, preferring to let his ad campaigns and their successes speak for themselves. But in this new season, as one of the partners in this new ad agency, that Don Draper won't do. He has to sell himself as well as the products of his clients if his new agency is to make it. And he's not alone. Everyone around him in this period drama is struggling to navigate and survive the 60s. And as they all struggle to do so, they help make it easier for us to survive the summer of 2010.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.